As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome, everybody, to Soccer 101. My name is Taylor Rockwell, and this week we're delving into the darker side of football to discuss doping. It recently made headlines with the confirmation that Paul Pogba would be suspended for 4 years after testing positive for banned substances, but he certainly isn't the first and likely won't be the last. What is doping? How is it tested? Who else has been caught? What are the punishments? Many questions to be answered. To do so, I'm joined by a man who just got done with an intravenous injection. He seems fully amped up and ready to go. Hi, Graham Ruthven.
Hello, Taylor Rockwell. Yeah, they just turned up at my house today, but yep. I was double screening it, watching like a Saudi Pro League game or a J League game or something. So yeah, had to turn them away. I'm sure there'll be no repercussions.
Yeah, that. None at all, Graham. I'm glad that you're fully fit and ready to go to discuss doping. As I said, I think it was a big story recently because of Paul Pogba, but it has been a big story in the past. If we're getting into the very basics of this one, what is doping?
Yeah, so doping is defined as the consumption of performance-enhancing materials and banned substances that are designed to improve sporting performance. That's what I found on the World Anti-Doping Agency website, WADA. So since 2004, that body has been accepted as the world authority on doping in sport, not just in soccer, and they established the World Anti-Doping Code. And FIFA adheres to that code. They've adopted that code. FIFA doesn't permit doping in football, and there is a banned list of banned substances. And if we just broaden it out very quickly to look at other sports, obviously it's been rife in other sports like cycling, which has completely ripped apart that sport. Countless doping allegations in cycling over the years. Obviously there was the Lance Armstrong downfall, which is the most notable doping case in history. In football, cases of doping, certainly not in the modern era, they're not quite as frequent, or rather proven cases aren't as frequent. But recently, as you mentioned, Taylor, we've had the Paul Pogba story. He's been banned from playing football for 4 years. So it does happen. And as I kind of referenced there, those are just the cases that we know about. Mm-hmm. There is a widespread belief that depressingly doping might be more common in football than often comes to the surface.
I think there's a decent chance it is. Graham, can you give me that basic definition one more time of doping?
Yep, so it's the consumption of performance-enhancing materials and banned substances that are designed to improve sporting performance.
So let's talk about those materials and banned substances, because doping sort of being the catch-all term for this, there are specific things, or maybe not specific medicines, because we're not going to try to get into pronouncing all of the scientific names. But Graham, when we talk about the different types of doping, what are we talking about?
We're definitely not going to get into pronunciations. We were talking before we started recording about what Paul Pogba has been banned for testing positive for. I don't even know where to begin with that substance. But yeah, you have different categories within the wider category of doping. So you have narcotics, which are injected into the bloodstream. They might be used when an athlete doesn't have much recovery time, and this might speed up that recovery time. You have steroids, which help to reduce swelling, pain, and other symptoms of inflammation. You have blood doping. So the reason for blood doping is to increase your red blood cell mass. and subsequently deliver more oxygen to muscle within your body. So this is a procedure where 1 to 4 units of a person's blood is taken from them. The red blood cells are then separated and stored in a refrigerated area, a cold area. The blood is then reinfused back into the body. So you might have heard of blood transfusions, mm-hmm. or something like that. That's what that is.
The Keith Richards way to beat a blood test. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he has WADA turning up at his door, though, periodically. No. Then you have things like creatine, which isn't strictly prohibited. So creatine might be something, I've never taken it myself, but I've been to a gym. I have seen it kicking around. Not strictly prohibited, but there are certain types that can cause problems in terms of being detected as prohibited in tests.
A couple other things to add in there. You've got banned stimulants like ephedrine, amphetamines, obviously because they're going to give you an energy boost, a performance boost. Many beta-2 agonists are banned as they help stress breathing. Those can be found in certain inhalers. There is I would call it a conspiracy theory. I think it's like 60% of the Liverpool squad have asthma and need inhalers. And so there's been some speculation that maybe Liverpool is getting around some of these restrictions. I think that might just be jealousy because they're fit and good to go. But who knows there? And then the other one worth noting would be masking agents and infusions that are above certain levels. That's how I believe Samir Nasri got banned. He had an infusion that wasn't banned substances, but it was substances above a certain threshold, then you become banned. And then masking agents would be anything that sort of seeks to hide the effects of what you've taken. So the famous one that you'll get in, I feel like, American sports, you hear about players testing positive for estrogen because that's a way to balance out the testosterone that you get from certain steroids. But then there's other ones, like I think Andre Onana is an example of a player who got a ban because he took his wife's like post-pregnancy pills accidentally, I think it was, which then could be considered a masking agent. So even if that was explained away, he still ends up getting, I think, an 8-month ban instead of the full year ban. But you do get those different types with those different punishments, all leading to the question of why a player would want to dope in the first place. And I think the answer is pretty straightforward. It's a very competitive game, this sport. Yeah. And when played at the very high level, it's a very competitive game that is very physically demanding, especially with the number of games players are playing in a season, especially with travel and just sort of wear and tear on the body. Steroids are going to make you get fit faster and build muscle mass and be able to handle the kind of physicality of leagues. And then obviously, if you're struggling with breathing, anything that's going to help with stress breathing is going to kind of improve that capacity. So that's, again, where you have the blood doping coming in, because that's going to help you just be able to recover faster.
Yeah, and I also think what is really common, Taylor, is players doping, or certainly verging on doping, taking a risk to reduce recovery time between matches. I mentioned that already. So what when you're talking about increasing players' endurance and strength and speed, I think that is all fair, but I feel like reducing recovery time is very common as to why a player would dope. I think sometimes people think when a player dopes, it's like Popeye, like taking spinach, and all of a sudden, I think a lot of the time it's just speeding up the natural process of the human body, if that makes sense, which is obviously still doping and illegal in sport, but it's maybe not. It's not like the Captain America process, where you wake up and all of a sudden you're hench. Although maybe sometimes that happens. Hasn't happened to me yet.
From what I have read, I have never taken them myself. From what I have read, certain performance enhancers will give you like the most insane energy boost you've ever had. Like the feeling of a kid when you're just fully sprinting and like, I could do this for hours and hours and hours. That level of energy and enthusiasm for exercise and running and just the intensity thereof, I think can certainly be an immediate performance enhancer. So I get the appeal there, but I also then understand why you shouldn't do that, because there are obviously massive side effects, and then also the fact that they are straight up banned. Probably not the best idea. So that leads us to how you might end up getting caught. As I understand it, the process, it can vary a little bit, but generally speaking, players will be randomly selected, Graham. Is that correct?
So information I have is, so this is just off on the basis of the FIFA guidelines, all players are obliged to undergo doping controls that consist of urine samples and blood samples. Mm-hmm. There's this other thing called the biological passport, so that was introduced during the 2014 World Cup, so relatively new innovation. Every player has a biological passport. And yeah, that's right, Taylor. A player can be asked to provide a test at any time. Checks are random. They can happen after a match, which is generally most common. A couple of players will get taken into doping control after a game. They'll be asked to provide the samples there. But test agents can also turn up to a player's house unannounced. And if a player refuses to provide a test, or if they are unable, they're not there to provide a test, they can receive a ban, which is exactly what happened to Rio Ferdinand. He was banned for 8 months back in the 2000s while he was playing for Manchester United for missing a test. Players aren't allowed to undergo
missing,
the...
quote-unquote, sure.
Yes, well, there's a little bit of speculation and conspiracy about
Rio
Ferdinand.
I was at the mall, and my phone didn't work. Sure, Rio, sure.
Yeah, it's a mall with thick walls, Taylor, the Trafford Centre. Players aren't allowed to undergo the test alone. Mm. This is the bit where I had to double-check with this, because the FIFA guideline says they have to be accompanied by a club doctor or a teammate when they're providing the sample. I kind of expected, I know there's a privacy element to this with like a urine sample and even a blood sample, I guess. I kind of expected it would be with a test agent rather than someone like besides your mate or like the club doctor, who we've had examples of clubs having doping schedules, like club-wide programs. So theoretically, you know, a doctor could be in on it, and then that's that could be compromised. There could be a violation there.
I don't know, Graham. I don't know if any doctors have ever been complicit in widespread doping allegations such that like
all,
an entire country got banned from the Olympics. Put it that
way. No, not at all. Called Russia.
So, a player, if they're selected, there are two samples taken. You've got the A sample that is tested immediately. This is what happened with Paul Pogba. That came up with traces of testosterone. The human body naturally produces testosterone, but the type that was detected basically indicates that there is an elevated level. Something else has been introduced to elevate that number. When a player tests positive, that sample A is then sort of the confirmation. Sample B is then tested or checked as a precautionary measure just to make sure that something wasn't tainted or tampered with. Player can request B sample be tested within 3 days of a positive test. And once that request is made, it must be delivered the results within 7 days. So you can't just have a player sitting there for months waiting to make sure that they're definitely banned. You get the process dealt with fairly quickly. And then once that has happened, the punishment comes in. Before we get to the punishment, Graham, let's talk a bit about doping in general when it comes to world football. Because as I said in the intro, it's not the most common thing, but it's not uncommon necessarily. We have plenty of instances going back to, I think some of the earliest ones I found were references to Arsenal in the 1920s using quote unquote pet pills. Sir Stanley Matthews allegedly used amphetamines in 1946. So much so that by the 1960s, the British government expresses concerns about doping in sport in general, but football in particular. And then up through the 1990s, in Italy, you have widespread usage of blood boosters, or at least alleged reported use. Juventus gets raided around this time. Yeah. Hundreds of pharmaceutical products discovered there and seized there. So you do have instances throughout the decades. Graham, I'm guessing you've got a few more to add to that equation.
Yeah, so you covered some of the ones that were in my list, but in 1954, there was one study that concluded that German players received injections when Germany won the World Cup that year. Yeah. In the 60s, Inter were the dominant team in European football at that point, and one of their players came out decades later and said the manager, Helenio Herrera, had given the team PEDs around that time. There are a lot of allegations that the Dutch teams like Ajax, Feyenoord and PSV were using PEDs in the 70s, when obviously they were doing very well, and those are the days of kind of like Cruyff and things like that. Players from that time have publicly spoken about this, so it's not just a conspiracy theory. There's some weighty allegations there. You have a good number of Algerian national team players who say they were given PEDs in the 80s. Tony Schumacher, who is a former German international, publicly said that there were a lot of players taking pills and injections during the 1986 World Cup. Maradona said that the Argentina team was given, quote, speedy coffee which I presume was his morning routine.
It makes
it was his morning routine for decades, I think. A cup of speedy coffee for Diego. That was before a qualifier for the 1994 World Cup.
Coffee makes you sweat out the slow parts. We all know that. That's how it works.
That's what I need. And then you get into the 90s and the early 2000s, and as you kind of referenced, Taylor, with Juventus, the focus shifted to Italy with allegations of doping. More recently, so this was never proven, I must stress that right at the top, but there are allegations against the Russian national team at the 2018 World Cup, when social media images bounced around of what looked like injection marks in the arms of players.
Artem Zuba very clearly had some stuff going on. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the other suspicious thing was all of a sudden Russia were running more than any other team at that tournament. Obviously made a run, beat Spain. So as I say, I must stress those are allegations. Nothing has been proven. But that was a theory around that team. So you can go all the way through the history of football, pretty much, as you say, Taylor, all the way back to the 20s, kind of close to its codification as a sport. And that's not long after that happens. And you can find doping allegations and cases throughout history.
There seems to be, in the Netherlands, there was a pretty pervasive usage of nandrolone. I think that's like the big one that was used that a bunch of people got caught for, including Edgar Davids and Jaap Stam. And very notably, Pep Guardiola twice tested positive for nandrolone. Antonio Conte was tested for blood boosters, which was apparently a treatment for anemia, and that ended up being overturned, I believe. But even as recently as like Fred, formerly of Manchester United, banned for a year for testing positive for a masking agent. So it's strange, Graham, because on the surface you see these examples, and with a few exceptions, like specific teams or specific programs, generally, I think the inclination is to think, oh, this is an individual thing. Individuals get their hands on it. There's, pressure to compete and pressure to stay at that top level. I sometimes wonder if it's a little bit more widespread and if maybe there's a little bit more systematic approach to some of this, or some of the stuff where it's just on the line of, like, you're not just fully injecting them with steroids like Ivan Drago, Rocky IV style, but maybe there's substances that are loopholes or not yet deemed to be. I think there's a lot of cutting edge science that goes into getting a competitive edge, shall we say.
Well, when you're talking about it being an institutional thing, that's the big reason why a lot of players will come out decades later or after they've retired and be very candid about, they'll say, look, I didn't have any knowledge of what was being injected into me or what I was taking. It was the club doctor that was giving me these pills or injections. That is pretty common. And one of the biggest scandals or stories regarding a team, an institutional program, was around Marseille in the early 1990s. Right. So they won the Champions League in 1993. They beat AC Milan in the final. There was a match fixing scandal around that team at the time. So they had their domestic Ligue 1 title stripped. They were relegated to Ligue 2 for that scandal. But on top of that, you had a number of their players, including Marcel Desailly, Chris Waddle. They came out and said that suspicious injections took place during that Champions League run. UEFA, in counter to that, they said that all the tests came back negative. But given the ethos of scandal around that club, which has been proven on the match-fixing side, and also the comments of the players that inject suspicious injections, they were never told what was in these injections, and then you had a team overperforming, beating one of the greatest teams of all time, as AC Milan were in the early 90s, most believe that Marseille were doping around that time.
Yeah, and I think that's where, if you go to FIFA's website, it is explicitly stated it is the player's strict responsibility to make sure that their body does not come into contact with any prohibited substance or method, and that they should check every medication or treatment they receive. Because I think one, maybe not workaround, but one explanation of the past has been like, well, I don't know, the doctor told me it was okay. Zenit St. Petersburg is a prime offender in this one. There were doctors who were basically just telling players, it's medicine, it's good for you, trust me. And I think a player is going to think, well, they're the club doctor, they're telling me to take it, why not? And I think in that gray area of the player isn't asking what specifically it is, and the doctor isn't being particularly forthcoming, the player might then be able to say, well, I didn't know, he told me to take medication. And I think that loophole was effectively closed, because that, like, requires the player to be accountable whether or not they know what's happening, whether or not they know that there's this, like, systemic approach in place. It's a little bit like if your accountant files your taxes but does a bad job and then you get audited. It's the accountant who did the bad job, but it's still your taxes. You're the one getting audited. You're the one who has to deal with it. So I think that was kind of a smart move, even if it's a ruthless move that kind of ends up punishing the individual and occasionally doesn't maybe handle the more systematic issue, put it that way.
Yeah, I think that's entirely fair. And the punishments, if you are caught out, can be severe. So there's no set punishment criteria that I could find. So it's not like blood transfusion, 18 months, steroids, 2 years. But if they are found guilty, if players are found guilty of taking performance-enhancing drugs, they are subject to a ban that could last several months. It could be years. It could even be a ban for life based on the severity of the individual cases. That is maybe where there would be some consideration of like an institutional or a systemic doping program. But nonetheless, it's expected that a player would still be banned. If the consumption of the banned substance was not intentional, so I'm reading again from FIFA's guidelines here. If the consumption of the banned substance was not intentional, bans can last for up to 2 years. So I don't think you can, in the scenario that we're talking about where a club doctor doesn't tell a player what's been injected into them, I don't think they can be banned for more than 2 years, but nonetheless, 2 years out of a career, players' careers are short. That is a serious, serious punishment. And even if you miss the test or it's believed you have misled testers or made it difficult for them to get the sample, you can be handed a ban like Rio Ferdinand was.
Yeah, and especially when that overlaps with a major tournament, somebody like Paulo Guerrero of Peru, for example, he gets banned for testing positive for a cocaine byproduct, which I believe was... He claimed, or maybe was confirmed to have been in a tea he drank that he didn't know contained that byproduct, didn't know that it would have the effect it did, but he ends up getting banned and I believe ends up missing a World Cup as a result. So it can have pretty disastrous ramifications, some of which I do feel sympathy for players when it does truly seem to be accidental. Like the Onana one, maybe it's just because I like him, maybe it's because he's Man United's goalkeeper, but that one seems a bit more genuine. Oftentimes to me, when there is a freak occurrence of I didn't know that medication had a masking agent in it, I find that a little bit harder to believe.
Well, the other one is Kolo Touré. So Kolo Touré was banned for 6 months. And I think the reason his ban maybe wasn't quite so severe was he was taking diet pills that apparently resulted in a test for a banned substance. So basically the moral of the story is if you're a professional athlete and you're being tested for doping, maybe be 100% sure about what you're putting into your body at all times.
Which I have some sympathy for players because, like, I have ADD. I'm sure there are many players who do as well, but if amphetamines are banned, you cannot take the medication for that, and I imagine that does not help you be the focused, diligent player that Pep Guardiola would like you to be. So at times it can feel restrictive, but then again, I think being able to ingest, Bill Burr has the joke about like baseball players in the 70s doing cocaine and then being able to see every stitch of the fastball as the ball is hurtling at you. Like, there are definitely incentives to be gained, put it
Maradona's secret, I think.
Yes, exactly. I don't think we need to throw allegedly in there when you can see his white fingerprints on the glass at the 2018 or 2022 World Cup. But Graham, the question then becomes for me, how prevalent is this? How big of a problem do you think it is? And I have two things I want to throw at you. So the positive one would be that if you're looking at how much is done to kind of prohibit this, to prevent it for the testing, there was an Athletic piece when the Paul Pogba story breaks. Here are the relevant details for what I'm talking about. During the Men's World Cup in Qatar last year, FIFA carried out 369 tests, which produced 941 samples. According to official data from FIFA, every player was tested at least once in the year building up to the tournament. Players from the 8 teams who reached the quarterfinals, Morocco, England, France, Brazil, Argentina, Croatia, the Netherlands, and Portugal, were tested on average of 4.6 times from January 2022. Some members of those 8 squads were tested up to 10 times. So that would have you believe that up to 10 times, up to 4 times, an average of at least once a year, that this testing is far-reaching, very common, very standard. Everybody gets tested. At the same time, in 2016, there's a study conducted by German-Moroccan academic Lofti El-Boussidi, who I believe was a former player. So he had connections to the game. He conducted anonymous interviews with players. He got 124 responses from footballers in Germany, Spain, and Sweden. Between 14 and 30% admitted to doping the previous year. 43% said they had never been tested. 50% said they had been tested once. So that math in the end worked out to footballers getting tested on average every 3.5 years. So you have FIFA saying it happens annually with your big name players, your big name teams, with your national teams. But then you have this sort of anonymous study, make of it what you will, yeah, that's saying it's closer to every 3.5 years. I don't think it's my conspiracy brain. I feel like I lean towards maybe it is not quite as common as FIFA would like us to believe.
Well, yeah, naturally you would believe the independent report, right, that doesn't have any skin in the game over FIFA, who might be trying to glorify or embellish their testing program, which is maybe not as stringent as they would like it to be. I think in modern soccer, it is fair to say, though, that testing is certainly more rigorous and more common than it was in past decades. So it feels like when I was doing my research for this, I was kind of a little bit shocked at just how many instances and allegations and proven cases as well there were throughout the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s. Maybe this is me just being naive, but I think in modern soccer, like over the last 20 to 25 years, I think maybe cases have become less common just because it is trickier to get away with. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that doping isn't happening. And I look at cycling. Yeah. So let's just believe FIFA, right? They say, what is it? Players get tested once a year, at least is what they say. Let's just say that is the case. Cycling thought they had things under control through the number of tests they were conducting, and then they found out that cyclists and their teams and doctors and whoever were finding ways to get around those tests. And in cycling, it got ridiculous. I've watched the Lance Armstrong documentary. I've watched a couple of documentaries. Yeah, there's things like, you know, cutting holes out of walls in bathrooms and feeding, you know, urine samples through the holes in the walls, and it got ridiculous. But you know, in a competitive sporting environment, those are the lens that certain athletes will take to get an advantage. And who's to say that football and soccer is any different? I mean, that's the risk. And every so often, you end up with a story or a case that feels like it's on the brink of cracking the whole thing open and finding out the truth. And the case that I would highlight in that regard is Operation Puerto, which was about 10 years ago. So basically, this was a huge investigation that focused on Dr. Efumiano Fuentes. Primarily, it did focus on cycling. And this case resulted in the suspension of many, many athletes. But some of the athletes in questioning, so this was a court case, and they talked to cyclists and other athletes who were clients of this doctor. And in those testimonies, if that's the right word, they revealed that players from La Liga would visit Fuentes at his surgery. And then there was a Le Monde report that said a bust on Fuentes' property by the police and by WADA had found seasonal plans for Barcelona and Real Madrid and records of payments from certain La Liga teams, including Real Sociedad, to Fuentes. Despite all of this, nothing really came of the allegations, but there is still a sense. Yeah, despite all of this, there's still a sense that a big story, especially in that period of Spanish football, is out there. And for a long time, I wrote about the Operation Puerto case for a number of years. I was writing for Vice at the time, and they loved that story. It was a very Vicey story. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote about it like at length two or three times. And I honestly felt like we were going to get to somewhere where it would just break open and, you know, there would be solid cases against clubs and players. It never happened. And it kind of just disappeared 10 years ago. But as I said, that doesn't mean that it didn't happen.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts there, because I think if we go back to cycling for a second, like there are individuals who are caught or there are individuals who are alleged to have done it. It seems to me like also commonplace was that whole teams were involved and whole teams were either complicit or actively doing it. And my assumption is that that goes for soccer as well. That if you have in modern football a desire to compete at every single level such that teams are willing to cheat when it comes to like false reporting of advertising numbers, misrepresenting of income and expenditure and transfers and, you know, like overvaluing of players to make it so that you have a better transfer difference. There's just so many different ways to skirt the rules and get around it for teams to be as competitive as possible. I have to believe that they're not avoiding the medical alternative. And I do think there probably is much more widespread I guess abuse would be the word. I'm guessing that it's sort of reading the banned substances, reading the restrictions, and then finding the little loopholes, finding the thing that isn't yet banned or is still in an experimental stage and finding ways around it. I think it is probably pretty common. I don't think it's full on labs where you are creating Ivan Drago or anything like that. But I think that there are probably ways that rules get bent and manipulated. So players either maybe are taking things that they don't know about, or players are taking things that they can be willingly ignorant of, or even just think are totally fine and above board when they in fact are not. And I think short of having like AI to go through every single possible thing that's given to a player, I think it's probably also somewhat not easy, but like difficult to your reporting, Graham, to what you're talking about, to go through and find every single thing that's been given by a doctor at a club or by a medical team at a club or whatever it may be. I don't know how easy those records are to obtain, because medical records tend to be pretty much confidential. So I think it makes it really hard, because there's just so many possible ways for it to happen, for it to occur.
The other thing is, obviously, there's that list of banned substances that WADA kind of controls. But principally, doping is legal to an extent in football. There is this kind of grey area where Luis Suarez, for example, takes painkilling injections in his knee every day so that he can train and play. That sort of thing is very common, and it's legal in soccer. Is that, in a sense, not like principally doping? It's a foreign substance that allows an athlete to perform at a level that otherwise they wouldn't be able to. So the point I'm making isn't really that Luis Suarez should be banned here, or that necessarily those types of painkilling injections should be banned. It's just, once you have that grey area, a player or a club doctor or whoever might find it more acceptable to just bend the rules that little bit more and have another injection that, well, okay, maybe this is kind of frowned upon or on a banned list, but look, you're taking injections for your knee to play. Like, there's not much of a difference there. So I think that is part of the discussion in soccer, is you already have certain things that are permitted that allow players to perform above their natural level.
And I know for a long time there were rumors in American sports, I'm just going to keep this as vague as possible, that certain players in certain leagues in the off season would go abroad to have transfusions and infusions because they weren't going to be tracked, they weren't going to be tested in the off season, so it was a way to kind of recover fully very, very quickly and then get back to training so that you were at full speed and maybe even better than full speed come the start of the next season. And I think that's like one way to get around that. I also know in American sports, there are provisions because of unions that if you've been tested once, you're not getting tested again. So if you've been tested once, you can then sort of maybe know that you're going to be fine for the rest of the season. And I think unrelated to any of that is just that I think it's always interesting when we talk about players. This is very much unrelated. And again, I'm trying to not maybe get us sued. But in the way that like when the Mark McGwire Sammy Sosa home run race happens, or when it happened, and there's just, it's like, how are these guys doing this? This defies all logic. This defies human ability. And I feel like, maybe I'm wrong, I was a kid at the time, but I feel like there wasn't much like, maybe we should pause and think about the things that we're saying in relation to this achievement and wonder if maybe there are some performance enhancers involved, since I believe both of them go on to have steroid scandals and maybe were doing steroids at the time. I think sometimes when we talk about certain players, there was, let's say, a very famous center back from Spain who would somehow always find this like next level of physical ability, like near the end of the season, as though maybe a cycle was being completed. Put it that way. Like, I think sometimes the way we talk about players can be insightful as to showing like, wow, this guy is defying all logic. How is he possibly doing this? And I think we want so much to chalk that up to commitment to physical fitness and belief in the system and working really hard and still being able to compete at that top level. But I think sometimes maybe it is also possible that other things are going on behind the scenes. It's just a really interesting story that is somewhat depressing, but also I feel like because of the sport that we exist in and the way the sport exists in the modern age, I think it's also not surprising. And I think when you have substances, like I believe marijuana is still a banned substance, but I don't know how much of a performance enhancer that is versus a facilitating recovery or pain reduction. Like, I think when you get into certain instances of things being banned, I'm not sure that necessarily needs to be the case either. So It's a confusing one. It's an interesting one. It's a depressing one all at once.
Well, let me tell you, marijuana was never a performance enhancer for me in college, so I'm not
like
sure.
That's competitive eating, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Joey Chestnut, better watch out. Taylor, just on the back of you calling it depressing, and I don't necessarily disagree with that. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the enhanced games? I don't know how much you know about this, so just to give you a very quick brief on this.
I'll tell you, all I can think of is the SNL bit about the all-steroid Olympics, when I believe it's Chris Farley has his arms ripped off while he's trying to do a deadlift. That's all I can think of.
Well, maybe that's how this will pan out, because essentially that is the idea, right? So it's Peter Thiel, right? Let's put that to one side, given some of his investments and his opinions. But anyway, a very rich man is backing this concept, the enhanced games that apparently will be held in 2025, and this is the Olympic Games for doped athletes. What do you think about that? Is there ever a scenario where doping could be accepted as just like part of sport? Or is that just pie in the sky stuff?
A small part of me feels like it's when the police department will stage the like, congratulations, you want a free boat, and send it out to all of the people who have warrants, and then they show up to get their free boat and they all just get arrested. Like, straight up saying, it's the doping games. Show up. We promise he won't be immediately arrested and tested and detained. That also comes to mind immediately. I mean, I guess it's interesting to me. To be honest, it feels like one of those, you scientists were so concerned with whether or not you could, you didn't stop to think if you should. Like, I don't know if that's necessarily a thing that we should be celebrating, but I am also a bit of a Luddite, I guess, a bit of a like, AI makes me uncomfortable, a bit of a, like, I don't know how much we should be tampering with, like, the human body and changing genetics or changing our physical makeup and our structure. But I know there are also reasons to do that, and reasons why that can, like, help cure disease and help, cure physical ailments. So I think it's a thing that makes me uncomfortable from the jump. And so I think like the enhanced games is not going to make me excited, maybe morbidly curious, but not excited. What about you?
Yeah. Well, I guess the biggest counter argument is there's a safety element here, right? Where doping can endanger athletes. But I come back to that, to drawing that line that I was talking about with the Luis Suarez painkilling argument. Excuse me. And I do accept that drawing that line is difficult. So I think I'm with you. There's a morbid curiosity, but I struggle to accept that it will be an accepted part of sport in the years to come.
It's strange, the painkilling injections, because it is a very common thing. It's ubiquitous in professional sports. Any movie about American football will have at least one shot of a player getting an injection into their knee, and then they're like, I'm good to go, coach. And that always ends up coming back to haunt that player, I feel like, 90% of the time. But like, it's not like, you know, amateur teams or lower level teams have that access to that type of medicine consistently. So in that way, it is an unfair competitive advantage. It is a performance enhancer, because you're not playing through pain. You're able to just play and go out there and make things happen. It's a slippery slope. It's a tricky one. I think I always just go back to, like, where does it stop? It stops somewhere. So maybe we can have more conversations about this as we go, Graham, because it does feel like one that will evolve as technology evolves and opinions on technology and scientific study continue to evolve. I look forward to chatting more with you about it.
Yes, there will be, depressing or otherwise, there will be more cases of doping in soccer and other sports further down the line. I think the Paul Pogba case, to bring it all the way back around full circle, that surely is as big a deterrent as any to any doping athlete, because his career's done. His career is done. Obviously, it was on a downward trajectory already, but I think he's like 30 years old now, 4 years out of the game. He's going to be 34. By the time he comes back to professional soccer, he'll have missed so much, you know, training and playing. He's done. He won't play at the top level again. And if you're a doping athlete and you see that kind of punishment, surely that makes you reconsider your actions.
And especially, I think, when you then combine that with legacy. Because for Paul Pogba, a player who is controversial, is not particularly beloved by Manchester United supporters, but for Juve, obviously, was so key. For France, was so important, and was one of the biggest players on the planet, one of the most influential players on the planet. And I think, had it have just gone the way it was going, it's like, you know, is it better to burn out or fade away? It felt like he was going to kind of fade away, maybe still be involved in the France team. Maybe he has a good summer at the Euros, but it felt like it was just going to be like that player who reached high levels, maybe didn't stay at the level that we thought he would for a very long time. But instead, it's a player who reached a high level, didn't stay at that level, and then was basically kicked out of the sport in disgrace. And it just changes a like generational player's like foundational identity, as or at least the way they're perceived, I should say. Maybe not their identity, but the way they are perceived publicly.
Yeah.
It's just it's a very strange thing that got coverage, but also kind of flew under the radar, I think, because maybe people are tired of talking about Paul Pogba and he wasn't playing much for Juve. But it's a pretty sizable moment for me in my soccer fandom and soccer interest. Yeah.
Don't underestimate how great that stain is when a player is found guilty of doping. Look at Maradona. A lot of people would say, I mean, maybe Messi has surpassed him in this argument now, but I'm sure you would find a lot of people who would still say he's the greatest player of all time. You wouldn't have to have a discussion for very long to get to the doping, well, not allegations, they were proven with Maradona and the doping cases with Maradona. So even a player as great as him, that is a defining part of his career.
All right. Once again, going to try not to get sued here. So I'll throw out an alleged to begin with, but like, didn't Messi take HGH? Weren't HGH human growth hormone treatments necessary for him to not be basically under 4 feet tall?
Yes, I don't think that's an allegation.
Like,
I think
under 5 feet tall, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, when he was a teenager at Barcelona, when he's brought over from Argentina, I think that was part of his.
I believe it was.
Like his contract wasn't with Barcelona. They couldn't get the treatment in Argentina, and so Barcelona, as part of their offer, said, "Look, come over to Spain, and we'll get you that treatment." So yeah, I think you're on safe ground there. It's not an allegation. That is something that happened in his teenage years.
So I think that goes with like the Suarez point of like it's not illegal, I'm assuming, since it was so public, and it is a like necessary treatment for a physical deficiency, essentially. And yet at the same time, it's not a thing that all players would have access to. Like literally, it's, as you said, it's why he moves to Barcelona. So it's just confusing one again of like you're contrasting Maradona to Messi, but Messi himself had to take things at a certain point to be able to be the player he is. So again, it just all gets murky really, really quickly. I think there is no purity test. There is no definitely this is happening, definitely this isn't happening. But I think that's also fairly common when it comes to the world of global soccer. So that seems like a good place to end it on, Graham, though maybe we'll revisit this one down the line or on TSS at some point when it rears its ugly head once again. For now, thank you for spending so much time talking about a difficult topic, a challenging topic, but an interesting topic all the same.
Thank you, Taylor Rockwell.
Listeners, thank you all so much for listening. We'll have another 101 episode in the feed this week because I was sick last week, so we didn't have time to record. So we're doubling up this week. We don't yet know the topic. Graham, do you have an idea for the topic? No? We'll talk about it later.